scripture reading this morning is found in Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 to 14, and chapter 3, 1 to 11. And I have a passage on the screen so we can all read together. So if you draw your attention to the screen, we'll read together the verses for this morning's message. Verse 11. Together, please. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." Let's continue. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that, though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, "I will go over and see the strange sight, why the bush does not burn up." When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." Then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?"
Francis, for helping us worship, and thank you, Linda. I trust that you have had a meaningful anniversary month. Now that all the feasting's over and now all the laughters are behind us, it is time to come back to work. The work of building up our church. Of course, it is by God's grace that this church is built up. But God uses each and every one of us by our giving, by our ministry, and that He builds His church up. And so for the next 2 months, I will begin a series of what I call models of servanthood. We're going to go through the scripture. We're going to see examples of servants of God and how God trained them up and how God called them and how God uses them. The text we'll be using will be familiar to us. The words may be even something that you remember hearing before. But the more familiar we are with God's word, the more we need to be reminded and the more we need to relearn the message that God has for us. Our church needs the services of each and every one of us. Every year after our anniversary month of September, we're going to begin the process of electing church council members for the coming year. And if things doesn't change, many of us will be nominated and most of those nominated will decline the nomination. Now, what does God have to say to us today at this particular juncture of the life of our church? I believe many of us decline the nomination, decline the invitation to serve in the church council for many different reasons. I believe perhaps you feel that you don't qualify. Perhaps you feel that you are retired and you do not want to take on any more responsibilities. Perhaps you feel like you have done the job already and there is no need for you to do the same. Perhaps you feel that you are serving in some areas already, areas that you prefer. For various reasons, you decline the nomination to serve and to take up the responsibility of being church council members. But we all have to remember, when you decline, that means others will have to do more. When you decline, we are building a church where 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work. Now, is that the kind of church that you want to build? This morning I want to revisit a very familiar text, Exodus chapter 2 and 3, where we see a man of God called to service by the name of Moses, and he declined. He stubbornly declined God's nomination. Moses stubbornly declined God's calling, and God will use this man to teach us three things. Number one, God does not disqualify us for service because we were once a failure. The second lesson is that God uses failures to break us for service. And thirdly, after we are broken, God rebuilds us for service by tempering our passions. When we begin with Exodus 3, we come to one of the most dramatic moments of human history. This is a moment when God made one of his rare personal appearances to man. This is a moment in time when he introduces himself by his very own personal name for the first time. This is a moment in time when God come to meet a man by the name of Moses at a place called Sinai. And God came personally to meet with Moses to call him and to nominate him to do a job that God has for him. Verses 10 to 11 in chapter 3. God said, "This is my job description for you. So now you go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Now what Moses said is something spoken by so many of us. When you are called, when you are nominated to take up responsibilities of being church council members. What did Moses say? "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I that I should go?" Has it ever occurred to you why Moses would say something like that? Was it because he was lazy? Was it because he was irresponsible? Was it because he was retired and he preferred a life of leisure rather than pressure? I don't think so. Moses said, "Who am I that I should go?" because he realized that he was a disqualified failure. Moses was a failure. He has lost all his credibility. At that moment in time, Moses had been a great failure. He has lost all his credentials. He was so burdened by guilt. He was so burdened by shame. That is why he said, "Who am I that I should go?" God was looking for a man, and God was calling a man to do the most impossible of jobs, to lead his people out of Egypt. God has his qualification in mind. God is really having a job interview in chapter 3 of Exodus. And what was God looking for in that job interview? Moses said, "Who am I that I should go?" When a man says that, he is measuring up to what it takes to serve God. When a man says, "Who am I that I could serve my God?" When a man says that, he is measuring up to what it takes to serve God. We need to remember who Moses was at that point. Moses had killed a civil servant in the Pharaoh's court. Moses was a murderer, and he has been a fugitive for 40 years. Not only was he a fugitive from the Egyptians, Moses was an outcast among his own people. See, we have to remember, Moses was brought up in the Egyptian court. He was raised a prince of Egypt. He was educated in the arts and the sciences of Egypt. He was groomed to rule. And to his own people, his own Jewish people, Moses was a turncoat. Moses was a collaborator with the enemies. He was second only to Pharaoh, and therefore he was just as guilty, he was just as responsible for the forced slave labor and for the death of numberless Jewish people. Moses was a criminal in the eyes of the Egyptians, and Moses was a stench in the nose of his own Jewish people. And what a failure of a man. From such height of glory and honor, now he's demoted to such lowly task of tending sheep. Of course he would say to God, "Who am I that I should go? I'm a disqualified reject. I'm a disgrace failure." And yet God came to him and God said, "I don't disqualify you for my service just because you were a failure. On the contrary," God said, "yours is exactly the kind of man I am looking for my service." Isn't it amazing how God works? Recognize how amazing our God works. It's just the opposite of the ways of the world. It's just the opposite of the ways of men. You're going to a job interview. Would you say to the interviewer, "I'm the wrong man for the job"? Would you say to the interviewer, "I'm a fugitive from justice"? Would you say to the interviewer, "I'm a felon, I have prior records of conviction"? Would you say to the interviewer, "I don't have any good references"? Would you say that to the interviewers? That's what Moses was saying back to God. Or put it another way, you are a manager and you are hiring someone for a position. What would you be looking for? You will be asking, "What have you done that was praiseworthy?" You are the manager. You'll be asking the one sitting in front of you interviewing for the job. You'll be asking, "What commendation have you earned? How many superior rating have you had in your annual review?" But that's exactly the opposite with God. God looks for the opposite in a man that who would serve him. Have you ever amazed at the fact that both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the most remarkable servants of God, they were both murderers? You realize that in the Old Testament, Moses was the most outstanding, the greatest servant of God. Moses was a murderer. And who was the most outstanding servant of God in the New Testament? It was Paul the Apostle. He was a murderer. He was guilty of accessory to murder. Moses was the lawgiver who says, "Thou shalt not kill." And yet he himself was a killer. How is it possible for a God who is holy and sinless and blameless, use a murderer, use a reject, use a failure to be one of man's greatest spiritual leaders? How can a holy God use an unholy man? How can a holy God use an unholy nation? How can an unfailing God use such a failure and reject? Let me tell you how. Because that is the only kind of people God has. I'll tell you how. Because that's the only kind of people that God has to work with. God does not disqualify us for his service because of our prior failures. Because God operates not on the basis of performance. God operates on the basis of grace. Your boss, where you work, operate on the level, on the basis of performance, but not our God. The sad thing about us Christians is that we don't know how to live in grace. The sad thing about us Christians is that we don't know how to work in grace. Moses was one of those people who don't know anything about living and working in grace. See, all the way up to this point, Moses had been living and operating on a level of performance. "Who am I that I should go?" he said. Moses was absolutely right if he uses performance to measure his qualification. See, by past performance, Moses was nothing. By past performance, Moses was ineligible. By past performance, Moses was a failure and disqualified. By past performance, the only thing that he was qualified to do, the only thing that he was qualified to lead, were those sheep who couldn't stop bleeping. He was so flabbergasted when he realized that God does not measure our qualification by performance. He was totally dumbfounded when he realized that it is precisely a man who has experienced failure and rejection that God was looking for. He was so amazed when he realized that it is precisely a man of brokenness, a man who is poor in spirit, that God was looking for. No past performance, but present brokenness. That is a lesson that every one of us who wants to serve God need to learn and need to remember and need to live by and need to work by. You want to use me, Lord? I don't qualify. Have you ever felt that you don't qualify? God, help us if we don't feel that way. Do not use your success in the corporate world to measure your qualification as church leadership. That's how so many churches elect the church leadership. Who and who, such and such a person, is so successful in the world, therefore he must be qualified to lead God's church. Do not use success in the corporate world to measure qualification to serve God in church leadership. Do not use your career training. Do not use the seminars, so many motivational sessions that you've been sent to measure your qualification in church ministry. A CFO, chief financial officer, does not necessarily make a treasurer God can use. A VP does not necessarily make a good trustee. A college professor who is so used in lecturing hundreds of students does not necessarily make him a preacher God can use. A person with a beautiful voice does not necessarily make him or make her a worship leader that God can find honor. A man with a doctor of ministry degree does not necessarily make him a good pastor. On the contrary, a person who thinks he qualifies for God's service because of his success in the world is exactly the kind of man who brings much difficulties in God's churches. I hope we all realize we don't qualify, because that is the only kind of people that God has to work with. But I must be quick to point out that just because God does not disqualify us because of failure does not allow us to glory in our failures, does not allow us to dwell in our failures. On the contrary, we need to remember we fail because we have not yet been broken. Failure does not qualify us, but unless we are broken and until we are broken, God still cannot use us. Our brokenness is the very first of qualification. See, we are all like broncos. You watch rodeo in television, you know what broncos are like? They do not like to be controlled. They do not like people to put a saddle on them. They do not like to submit. They do not like to be ridden. Cowboys go on a bronco, a wild bronco. The bronco is going to kick. The bronco is going to jump. The bronco is going to shake. Because the bronco, wants to get that cowboy off his back. But unless a young bronco is saddle broken, he's no good for any use. Moses was exactly such a bronco. And in Exodus chapter 2, he was not yet broken. Moses in chapter 2 was a man of great passion, but it was an immature passion. He was proud, he was arrogant, he was impulsive. He was so sure of himself. He thought he could do it all. See, passion is not a bad thing for a servant of God. Anyone who wants to serve God needs to be a man of passion. You know what a man without passion is like? Look into your refrigerator. Look to the back of the refrigerator, low at the corner. A man without passion is like leftovers in your refrigerator, cold and stale and even moldy, ready to be taken out to the garbage on the street and ready to be dumped into the landfill. But everyone who ever wants to serve God must be very careful about his passion, because immature passion is a very dangerous thing. Unchecked passion is a very destructive thing. Have you ever made rice over a very high fire? Okay, you come home from work, you are hungry and you want to make rice fast, you cannot wait. So you think to yourself, I'm going to use the biggest burner on my stove, thinking that the higher the fire, the faster you will accomplish your task of making your rice, right? But what happened when you make rice over high fire? You burn the bottom, and the water boils over and make a mess of everything. Not only that, the bottom of the pot is burned and the top is uncooked. In Chinese, Cantonese, we call that sam gap dai. Three levels of cooked rice. If you want to cook rice over high fire, your wife's going to be very mad at you. Your children are going to be mad at you. That's exactly what immature passion is like. And that was the trouble Moses had. His failures can be traced back to his immature passion. And because of his immature passion, we see the mess that he made. You see, Moses was born into troubled times. His own people were under heavy yoke of slavery, and Jewish people were at the mercy of the Egyptian slave masters. And yet, Moses was born and raised and still living in luxury and privileges. And we also see that he was a compassionate, caring man. Chapter 2, verse 11 tells us that one day Moses had grown up. He went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. And he saw the Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Now, he would not have gone out to where his people were unless he was compassionate, unless he was caring. He could have turned his blind eyes to their suffering. He could have turned his deaf ears to their cry. He could have shut himself off from their suffering and misery. He could have pretended their suffering never existed. He could have stayed in his palace and enjoyed a good life. And yet he cared enough to go out to where the suffering was. It takes a compassionate and it takes a caring man to do that. And what he saw roused him to compassion. What he saw got his heart pumping. And what he saw got his blood boiling. Verse 12 tells us that glancing this way and that way, seeing no one around, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Now what this verse tells us is that Moses has a passion, but a passion unchecked, a passion uncontrolled. You see, it takes passion to kill. You say, what's wrong with killing the Egyptian? It was evil, it was injustice that roused Moses' passion. The Bible is full of passages, Pastor, that tells us God loves justice. God hates oppression. The prophets again and again speaks out against injustice and against oppression. So what Moses did was good. What Moses did was just. Not quite. Moses acted presumptuously. Moses acted on his own. He thought he could right the wrong on his own terms. He thought by his one passionate act, he could bring about the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. But that was not what God had designed. That was not what God has planned. And what good is a passion that is not checked? What good is a passion that is not controlled by God? Not a whole lot of good, is it? Moses' passion boiled over and made a terrible mess. A passion that is not checked, a passion that is not controlled, is a crime. What Moses did was a crime. It was a crime of passion. Moses killed out of his immature passion. what Moses did and what it teaches us ought to stay with us at all times. A passion for God is good and necessary. But unless a passionate man learn to temper his passion under God's control, not only will his passion not be used by God, it will do even more damage than good. Moses was young and passionate. He has to learn how to temper his passion. Even though he has all the academic degrees that a man can earn, he was smart, he was confident in his own training and ability. He was proud, he was arrogant, he was so sure in himself, and yet God says, Moses, not yet. Not yet. I cannot use you yet. I need to break you first. God said that to Moses, and God will say to each and every one of us, no one who is unbroken can be used for God's service. And most often, God uses failures to break us. I have met so many seminary graduates. They are young. They have read all the books in the library. They are so sure of themselves. They mistake their self-confidence for faith. They are going to do great things for God. But one by one, they fall by the roadside. This illusion about ministry, and many abandon their calling because they have not yet been broken. Seminaries are very good in making us read books, but seminaries are very poor in breaking broncos. God is very good in breaking wild broncos, and he uses failures to break broncos. And our God rebuilds his servants after they are broken. That is what God did to Moses. It was true for Moses. It is true for us. Those of us who are teachable can be rebuilt. And how could a young man like Moses be broken and rebuilt? A young man so headstrong, so hard-blooded, so gifted, and so sure of himself. How could any of us be broken and rebuilt? A very simple word. Teachability. When a man is unteachable, when a man refuses to learn, no matter how gifted he may be, no matter how talented, how brilliant he may be, he could not be rebuilt. He could not be used by God. But when a person is teachable, he will not be defensive. He will not look for excuses. And he will accept correction from anyone, even those he does not like. That's teachability. What Moses needs to learn is the same for any young man, the same for any seminary graduates, the same for any church leaders. What Moses needs to learn is the same for any elders or deacons and pastors to learn. We need to learn to temper our passions. Numbers, the book of Numbers 12, chapter 12, verse 3, tells us that now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. But at this chapter 2 in Exodus 2, Moses was anything but meek and humble. Moses in chapter 2 in Exodus was like a tornado, a raging tornado, a raging hurricane, ravaging hurricane, going around 200 miles an hour, wrecking everything in his path. And then God said, Moses, you need to learn to temper your passion. But Moses, are you teachable? Exodus 2:15 tells us that when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. And for the next 80 years, Moses lived in the wilderness. 40 years tending sheep and 40 years bringing the Israelites out. And God uses those 80 wilderness years to teach Moses to temper his passion. Let's look closely at how God taught Moses to temper his passion. God says, Moses, you are not allowed to extinguish your passion. But God says, you need to humble it. You are not allowed to extinguish your passion. You just need to humble it. See, a lot of people, when they go through setbacks in life, they become cynical. They become convinced that there's no good left in life. That's extinguishing their passion. They become convinced that there's no good in any church anymore. A church member had a very unhappy experience in church. He becomes cynical and he never goes back. A pastor has had an unhappy experience in his church. He becomes cynical and he abandoned the ministry. Cynicism will do more damage to a Christian than immorality, than false teaching. We have all the holiness of life, we have all the right teaching, but cynicism in a Christian's heart will do more damage. After Exodus chapter 2, Moses could have been the biggest cynic in all the characters in the Bible. Moses trained to be leaders of men. He was expected to be movers. He was expected to be shakers. But now in his 40, do you know what 40 means to a man? When you are 40 years old, you are entering the most dangerous stage of your man's life. 40 is the age when a man is moving toward the peak of his career. When a man is 40, he's at the pinnacle, at the plateau of his productivity and success. And what happened to this man, Moses? He fell from the top of power to the depth of disgrace with one stroke of his arms. I can imagine day in and day out in the heat of the day, in the cold of the night, in the desert, all that Moses could hear was the howling of the winds and the howling of the jackals. And all that he could hear was bleeping of the sheep. I can imagine Moses with all his former aspiration, with all his dreams of greatness and grandeur, all were shattered. I can imagine him sitting there on the rocks thinking to himself, what am I doing here? I can imagine him sitting on the rocks thinking to himself, what more is there left for me? I am washed out. I'm finished. I am forgotten. You see, to a man with Egyptian upbringing, being a shepherd was the worst disgrace a man can suffer. And here's Moses, from the position of highest honor to the place of lowest disgrace. You see how cynical Moses must have been? No wonder Moses refused and declined God's nomination. Moses was in fact saying, God, you've got to be kidding. You want me? Hey, I tried it once and it didn't work. God, you must be making a mistake. God, you must be calling the wrong man, not me. I am history. The fire I once had burned out 40 years ago. Besides, I couldn't talk, and even if I could talk, no one would listen. But God would not allow him to stay in his cynicism. God would not allow him to extinguish his passion. See, Moses' passion was dampened, but God needs to teach him to rekindle it. And after it is rekindled, God needs to teach him to check it with humility. Setbacks are great for teaching and checking immature passion. God said to Moses, I'm glad your passions have been dampened. I am glad because your passion were running on its own fuel. God says it was a passion that had you yourself as a source. If I had allowed you to liberate my people with a passion of yours, it would never work, because it would burn out long before you even get to the starting gate. Now I'm glad, Moses, that you did not lead my people out with the passion that you had. Now that your old passion of yours is being brought under my control, you will see what I can do. A passion that comes from our own desire and will is destined for trouble. But God would not allow Moses to extinguish it, only to rekindle it, and only to bring it under God's control. You see, Moses had to learn it the hard way, and it is no different from any of us. Moses was a meek and humble man later in life because he was teachable. God also taught Moses to temper his passion with challenges and with difficulties. See, whether we are useful or not depends on how we handle provocation. Provocation comes to us every day and from every corner and from every angle. Your wife will provoke you. Your husband will provoke you. Your children will provoke you. Your pastor will provoke you. Your fellow church members will provoke you. Those are challenges and difficulties that comes our way. And God uses provocations to temper our passion. Do you know how many times the Israelites provoked Moses? Moses was so reluctant to take up leadership and responsibility for good reasons. He was no dummy. He knew exactly what he was getting himself into. When he said to God, "I don't want to go. I don't want a job," he was perfectly content with watching the sheep. They were all sheep. The only provocation that he could get from them was just all the bleeping, all the blah, 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 all the sounds. But if he were to obey God's call and nomination, the sheep that he was called to tend are going to be the people of God. And he knew that if he were to obey the call and to accept the nomination to tend the people of God, he would get nothing but pain. When they had no meat, they complained. When they had no water, they complained. When they had water and meat, they still complained, because they would complain that they detest those food that God gave them. Moses led them to the door of the promised land, but they refused to go in. He was up in the mountain just a little bit longer. Not only did they complain, his own brother made an idol and led the people to worship idols. They had just crossed the Red Sea. They had personally witnessed divine power that no one has ever seen before, and yet how quickly their hearts would turn and change. His own brother, his own sister turned against him, and over 1 million people all came to him with all kinds of problems. Someone with a runny nose would come to him. "Am I clean? Am I unclean?" You read the laws of Moses. If you have discharge, you better worry whether you are clean or not. Some man has a balding hair. They come to him. "What do I do? What do I do?" Some husband and wife fight. They would come to him and complain. No wonder Moses permitted divorces. There were so many domestic fights that he had to settle. How much more can a man take? God taught him to temper his passion with all these challenges and difficulties. And yet the greatest challenge and greatest difficulty that Moses had to face was his own ego. You see, time and time again, God said to him, "I'm fed up with these Israelites. But out of you, Moses, I'm going to raise up a new nation." The greatest challenge for every man is his ego. Every man wants to be remembered that he was a founding father of something. Again and again, Moses was given the opportunity. So many times God offered him that opportunity to be the new founding father of a new nation. That is a greater challenge Moses had to face. Offer of name recognition for all times. It's a challenge very few people can meet with success. And yet Moses met it with success. He said to God, "Don't do it, don't do it. Don't do it, not because these rebellious people deserve your grace, but don't do it because of what the Egyptians might say about you. Don't do it because of what the other nations might say about you. Don't do it, God, because my name is not important, but your name, O God, is what I care about." You see, Moses was learning to channel his passion for God's honor. Moses was learning to channel his passion for God's glory and name. It came from what he learned from all those challenges and all those difficulties every single day of those 80 years. Dear people, if you find your family life easy and comfortable, something is wrong somewhere. If you find your ministry, if you find your service easy and comfortable, something is wrong somewhere. Ease and comfort does not strengthen anyone. Heating and beating strengthen. Have you ever seen a blacksmith temper steel and strengthen steel? Have you ever seen a blacksmith get rid of the impurity in a piece of steel that he's working with? He heats it and then he beats it with a hammer on an anvil. It is a heating, it is a beating that tempers and strengthens steels. Moses took the heat, Moses took the beating, and it was through this process that God rebuilt Moses. Pray not for ease nor comfort. Ease and comfort does not do us much good. Pray for heating, pray for beating, because it is the same process that God uses to temper you and to strengthen you. Pray that God would do the same for you as he did to Moses. See, in a few weeks, many of us will be nominated for service. I know already that many of us will decline. I know already many of us will not accept the responsibility. You will not accept the nomination, the calling. You have your reasons. I understand that. But remember one thing. If you decline, you are making 20% of the people to carry on 80% of the responsibility of the church we love so dearly. Let's all stand. We're going to sing a response hymn together.